wanted the album to be very extreme. We didn't want it to sound in any way safe. You know, I was listening to a lot of really out there experimental dance music and
at the time,
yeah, hardcore kind of guitar music and industrial music, and I just really love the energy of it and the sounds of it, and the, you know, it's music that really confronts you and challenges you.
One love, we get to share it. Leaves you, baby, if you don't care for it.
Musically, we had reached a stage where just wasn't happening. It wasn't much fun anymore. It was actually too difficult. So when we went in to make Octane Baby, it was difficult to make. It was a difficult record to make.
We're not denying the past. We're not turning our back on our previous records. But this record is so different. It represents the two extremes of what we are. And somewhere in between the two is really where we stand.
You were acting like it was the end of the world.
The worldwide successes of both the Joshua Tree album in 87 and the subsequent Conspiracy of Hope tour, which made U2 international superstars, were documented in the movie Rattle and Hum. Making a feature film in itself took the band outside of its rock comfort zone into the image-conscious big bucks world of Hollywood. Since its inception a decade earlier, U2 had been the rock band to take on big issues in earnest quite regularly and to mate their lyrics to big, anthemic melodies. The resultant popularity had combined with media frenzy by the dawn of the 90s to create a mythology about U2. As the band entered the studio to record what would become Octane Baby, U2 lead singer, lyricist Bono realized for the first time the scrutiny that goes with superstardom.
How do you avoid? I mean, you got to a precarious edge, no pun intended, a precipice. How did you reel it in?
Well, I think one thing is not to be defensive. And we've been very defensive in the past. Again, I think that's an Irish thing. You know, if your back's up against the wall, you can get quite aggressive. And even musically speaking, this has been true. And that appears to some people as pompous. You know, like not giving access or precious, you know, that kind of thing. I think we've learned recently to just, that we actually have in the end, that we've nothing to hide, you know, as a band. So why don't we just kind of, you know, maybe we should, you know, a bit of glasnost could go this way, and this particular gang of four has nothing to hide. So we just kind of we had to let go of something. I don't quite know what it was that we were letting go. We were holding on to the group too tightly. And I think it came across, it made the music a little too taut. It made squeeze my voice. And it was just coming out of Dublin, coming out of Ireland, not knowing how the hell to be in a rock and roll band, not knowing what you should do, not wanting to get ripped off, not wanting to get, you know, all not wanting to fall into those traps, and kind of not being very loose about it. And
it's understandable.
If there's one thing I'd regret of the 80s, it was just an uptightness. And it was an uptightness that sharpened our music on a lot of levels, but it spoiled our own enjoyment of it.
You're the real thing.
last chance, and I'm gonna make you sing. Give me half a chance to ride on the waves that you bring. Your hundred shouts to a swarm of bees, gonna blow right through you like a breeze. Give me one last dance to slide down the surface of things. You're the real thing.
From 1991's Achtung Baby with Even Better Than the Real Thing. The whole world had watched during the last week of 1989 as the Berlin Wall, that notorious symbol of repression and communist rule over Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, the wall fell and Germany was reunited. U2 decided to record their new album there in Berlin, Germany, with producer Brian Eno, the same combination of producer and place that David Bowie had used so dramatically 15 years earlier for his groundbreaking Heroes album. I asked U2 bass player Adam Clayton and guitarist The Edge to describe East Berlin on Unification Day.
We kind of moved into the closest thing to a kind of luxury hotel in the East. And it was like right opposite the Stasi headquarters, which is like this huge building where the secret police used to kind of do all their kind of deeds. And more or less wherever you go, there's kind of cameras somewhere. And the staff were telling us in this hotel that before the kind of Stasi were dismantled, well, nobody really knows if they have been dismantled, but that everyone in that hotel was Stasi informers, that all the rooms were bugged and had cameras in them.
Now, do you get the feeling that you've just kind of stumbled onto the set of a 1960s Ian Fleming, James Bond movie, or does it really sink in that this was a way of life?
It's not, I mean, my reaction to it was not so much of nostalgia, but it was, if this is what these people
of a surrealism.
Yeah, it was kind of, if that's what these people have come through, how long is it going to take them to really adjust to freedom? And it was, they were dazed, you know, the people were dazed. They didn't really know how to cope with it.
Well, what was great was it was like it was over, you know, the nightmare had ended. And it was, we had arrived just at that moment in Berlin. And so everything was new, everything was up for grabs. It was as if there were no rules anymore. And people were, as Adam was saying, a bit dazed, but really kind of waking up. And that was an interesting thing to witness. The East Germans that we saw and met, you know, there was a little bit of confusion about quite how we lived.
What do we do next?
Like, I heard stories of people hitting West Berlin for the first time, walking into supermarkets, loading up the trolley and trying to walk out the door because they had imagined that everything was free in the West. And there was this kind of horrible dawning that, you know, maybe the alternative to communism wasn't quite as great as they maybe had been led to believe.
Someone from U2's creative team tossed some early rough mixes of songs into the hotel trash bin that surfaced as bootlegs in Europe months before the actual Achtung Baby album was finished, making me wonder if the award-winning album we all know is the same one they started to make. First, Adam Clayton, followed by The Edge of U2.
No. it took us a while to kind of relearn, you know, what we were doing and trying to get to the essence of the songs and, you know, to feel happy. We'd kind of forgotten how hard we kind of find it in the studio sometimes. Because you're kind of playing against yourself every time. You know, you can finish early and think you've got something great done, but you've got to go that extra mile. And we kind of had, I suppose, the first 3 weeks of kind of shouting at each other. And then after that, it started to gel and something started to come out of it.
Well, the point is, you know, we could have got into the studio and done a record of songs like along the lines of what we've done before, like Joshua Tree Part 2 or whatever. We decided that just wasn't going to work for us, and none of us were interested in doing it, and I don't think we could have done it as it happens, because we had moved on, our interest had moved on, the music we were listening to was different. So in a sense, part of the problem was deciding what we did want to do and figuring out how we were going to do it. And that means, you know, if you're writing the songs, it all the rules that you applied to previous records had to be thrown out. And that does take time, and there's a lot of experimentation involved. You know, some of the songs we actually wrote maybe two or three versions of before getting to the final one. Some of those alternative versions ended up going on the Berlin bootlegs, which have been circulating. And they're like the demos, the first phase of the writing of these songs. So in Berlin, we were struggling a little with some of the material, realizing that it probably wasn't where we wanted it to be, and trying to develop it, trying to push it into certain areas.
U2 drummer Larry Mullen Jr. told me an even more frank assessment about the initial recording sessions for Achtung Baby.
I think musically, after Rattlin', when we look back on it, musically we had reached a stage where just wasn't happening. We went in to do the recordings for Achtung Baby, and we'd sort of lost touch a little bit. Well, at least I felt that I had lost touch with the culture from where we'd actually come, and to come to a stage where I sort of felt that I couldn't bring anything new to the band, and I felt that it wasn't much fun anymore. It was actually too difficult. And I think we all felt similarly, not exactly the same. We also, you know, we all felt in and around the same way. And so when we went in to make Achtung Baby, it was difficult to make. It was a difficult record to make in the beginning, particularly because we hadn't been around for a while after Rattlin' Home. We'd sort of gone and done our own thing for a while, and basically the bigness of all that, like the megadom, had taken its toll, and people just were a little bit confused.
So you see, not only did Achtung Baby almost not get made, you too came perilously close to breaking up, not from failure, but at the height of their success. So what was the tipping point? First Bono, then Larry, then The Edge with me in the studio.
We never thought we could answer all our fans' questions. I think it might be more accurate to say, when do we stop trying to explain ourselves? And because we used to feel that if we just could, you know, if we could actually get it right, if we could, you know, if we could explain ourselves, people would see where we're coming from. And we stopped that over the last few years and just started it again for this interview. But we never thought we never saw ourselves as any kind of...
I mean, that's actually a complete load of crap that people would sort of say, you know, spokespeople for a generation, and throw this thing at us. And, you know, it was just...
I think think partly it was because of the place, Ireland, you know, that we had come out of.
That's right.
It was going through a period of incredible social upheaval. It was being dragged, kicking and screaming, into the 20th century, socially speaking, and there was a great kind of period of self-re-examination and a lot of excitement about the future, about the potential of the country, and you know, people in the country really starting to feel that rather than kind of having to go abroad to feel like you're in the thick of it culturally, you know, in terms of world media, world cinema, world music, world whatever it is, that it was actually suddenly it was happening on your doorstep, because we were part of Europe, we were part of what was happening, what was it. And that sort of spirit of re-examination and trying to find your place, I suppose, in the big globalized melting pot of the 80s, I guess that started to come through in our music. And it was our own questions, I suppose, that we just put into the songs. We weren't trying to answer them for anyone else. We were just trying to come to terms with some of these questions for our own selves.
Yeah.
That's the perfecto mix of Mysterious Ways from U2's Achtung Baby Deluxe Edition. Next, you'll discover why Bono described this album as, quote, the sound of chopping down the Joshua tree. I'm Redbeard with The Edge, Adam Clayton, Larry Mullen Jr., and Bono in the studio for Achtung Baby. Welcome back in the studio. The anniversary of U2's Achtung Baby album, Rolling Stone magazine's number 62 of the top 500 greatest albums of all time. I'm Redbeard, and even though their 1987 album, The Joshua Tree, had been both critically heralded and an international blockbuster commercially, U2 surprised a lot of people by not staying in the same musical area code. First, here's guitarist The Edge, followed by bass player Adam Clayton of U2 with me in the studio.
We wanted the album to be very extreme. We didn't want it to sound in any way safe. You know, I was listening to a lot of really out there experimental dance music. And
at the time?
Yeah, hardcore kind of guitar music and industrial music. And I just really love the energy of it and the sounds of it. And the, you know, it's music that really confronts you and challenges you, and I wanted some of those kind of elements in what we were doing.
I think we'd also kind of made a decision that we were going to kind of take on technology and embrace it, which was like the opposite of what we'd been doing for, say, the Rattle and Hum record, where we said, let's strip it down and just play the songs live. So we needed to get to grips with, you know, the kind of equipment and stuff and find the sounds that we wanted. So it was quite kind of a learning experience in that respect.
You're dangerous, 'cause you're honest. You're dangerous, you don't know what you want. Where you left my heart, empty as a vacant lot. For any spirit. You're an accident.
From November 1991's Achtung Baby album, that's U2 with Who's Gonna Ride Your Wild Horses. I asked Bono about the lyrical shift in perspective on Achtung Baby.
And we had this sense that rock and roll isn't about any one thing. You know, it's like, it's, you know, we were into people that just mixed it all up. You know, one song can be as dumb and as stupid as you want. The next song can be what's going on the street in a very real way. And we weren't going to leave politics out. We weren't going to leave sexuality out. We weren't going to leave spirituality out. We weren't going to leave anything out. That was our version of rock and roll. There was going to be nothing we couldn't write about or talk about. We didn't think that our opinions, you know, were any more important than anyone else's. But we knew they were as important as anyone else's. And if you just go into any pub in this town, and you're going to have people sitting up at the bar, you know, mouthing off. And, you know, their opinions don't even have to be informed. Our opinions don't even have to be informed. We're just, in one sense, that's what we do. We mouth off. I mouth off. And it's just, I guess there's a lot more people listening than there is in the pub around the corner. But that's Irish people. Irish people are like that. It's a cultural thing. And I'm sure a lot of people go, you know, let's just gag them, you know. And, you know, I turned on the radio because I wanted to rock, you know, and this guy, what's he on? And it's just Irish people. I just like that. And not all Irish people. I can see now the old Irish, we are not. no way. But, you know,
we'll tell you why.
Concept of the mouth is popular around here. You met Bob Geldof. you know, it's just, it runs with it. You know, it's no big deal.
But U2 and Bono in particular would continue to use their celebrity as a forum for addressing issues that are a very big deal. U2 found that the initial video to the song One, featuring the band members dressed in drag, was being misinterpreted. So they brought in a creative team to produce a simple visual collage built from photos of flowers and alternately buffalo stampeding over a cliff made by New York City artist and photographer David Wonorowicz. This stunning video played silently on the huge Vitti walls as U2 sang the song One live on the Zoo TV tour, a most powerful combination. I asked bass player Adam Clayton why the proceeds from the sale of the song One were donated by U2 to AIDS research.
First time we came to America, 1980, the taxi driver was saying, I'm sorry, you know, I can't take you that way. There's some kind of a demonstration going on. And we said, well, you know, what's it about? He said, I don't know. There's like all these kind of fags and they're complaining about some disease and, you know, nobody's kind of given them any money to sort it out. And that was like the first time I heard about it. And it was always considered a kind of small issue. But like suddenly it's a very real issue. And still you get the feeling that people aren't really responding to it. I mean, not at government level. You know, it's a kind of humane response. Whenever people kind of get into AIDS, they start talking about morality. And I don't think morality has got anything to do with people dying. I think it's a humane issue. I think that there should be relief for sufferers with AIDS, and I think there should also be research. So with the proceeds of One, we are helping to finance in whatever way we can. Also, the artist involved, David Wonorowicz, is dying from AIDS. And over the years, he's been very active in kicking up a fuss about, you know, AIDS not being taken as a serious issue. And I think we felt we wanted to honor him and his work and take an image of the buffalo being driven to death over the cliff as a very telling apocalyptic image of what will happen if we don't find a cure for AIDS.
Is it getting better? Or do you feel the same? Will it make it easier on you?
explain. You're saying one love, one life, when it's one need in the night. One love, we get to share it. Leaves you, baby.
By the time the U2 tour reached Australia in December 1992, artist David Wanarowicz had already died at age 37 from AIDS. A simple epitaph from David himself was added to the end of the video to the song One, which features his photographs. The epitaph simply says, "Smell the flowers while you can." Next, find out which of Jesus Christ's original 12 disciples is the character that Bono chose to sing the U2 song Until the End of the World. I'm Redbeard with Bono, Larry Mullen Jr., Adam Clayton, and The Edge in the studio for the anniversary of the number one seller, Achtung Baby. Welcome back to the anniversary of U2's Achtung Baby, the 1992 Grammy Award winner for Rock Album of the Year and number 62 on Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 all-time list. I'm Redbeard. To fully understand U2's song Until the End of the World, you need to realize that the singer is, in fact, Judas Iscariot, the disciple who betrayed Jesus Christ. And the "you" referred to repeatedly is Jesus himself. U2 guitarist The Edge explained it all to us in the studio.
This was a piece that Bono had started quite a while ago. He's fascinated with those kind of great inner kind of confusions and debates, the battle between love and loyalty. All, you know, these are what the great, you know, themes
of all time,
right?
Humankind.
So he was fascinated with this relationship. You know, I mean, Judas is an amazing character. When you think about what he did, you try to start to see why he did it. It is an amazing thing. And he started writing just some lines about this relationship, the two characters. And then a couple of weeks into the recording of the album, he was sent this book to review by this Irish poet. What's his name?
Brendan Kennelly.
Called The Book of Judas. And I was like, completely out of the blue. And his entire book of poetry is kind of this theme of this conflict. There was one line from Brendan Kennelly's book that really became almost, it was an idea that seemed so in tune with what we were doing. And it's a line in one of the poems which goes, "If you want to serve the age, you must betray it." We used that as an idea for some of what we were doing, you know. In a sense, that was part of what we were trying to do with this album. And I suppose if you see that the truth lies between two different points of view, you can't really say exactly where it is. And you too right now is in that position. We're not denying the past. We're not turning our back on our previous records. But this record is so different. It represents the two extremes of what we are. And somewhere in between the two is really where we stand.
Right and groom, waiting
Until the End of the World from U2's Achtung Baby. Several years before the proliferation of the internet, U2 took on the information age, which in 1991 was symbolized by 24-hour cable and satellite TV. The 92-93 Zoo TV Tour was the first large-scale challenge to this information age to question, do facts equal truth? Is information the same as understanding? The DVD, U2 Zoo TV Live from Sydney, satisfies the one regret that Adam Clayton had with the live show back then.
I think people do need to see it a few times.
Part of it is that point, though, is you know, when we go into the fly as this barrage of information and random words, people come away seeing the most unusual phrases that really aren't there. Like, we had one journalist who saw Bomb Japan Now.
And printed that
printed in the review.
In another, Japan Press, right?
Another girl.
Yeah, kind of nearly caused diplomatic
incidents. International
incidents. It was a bit heavy. Then this other girl I spoke to recently said, why have you got everyone's a rapist on your video walls? And I scratched my head for a minute and remembered that, in fact, what it says is everyone's a racist except you. But, you know, people can completely misinterpret it. And almost that's the point, is like, there's all this information, but is information the truth? I don't think necessarily. Information is what's out there, you know, and information is what seems to be ruling the world right now. Information about your politicians, information about war, you know, the CNN news reporters right there on the scene giving you information. But what does it mean?
But is it true, even?
Exactly. Is it any more true than, you know, what you might hear down in the bar, you know, talking to some guy? You know, I don't know is the answer. But information doesn't not necessarily equal truth. And in this case, we're playing with that. You know, we're not trying to make a heavy point of it, but it's like we're quite playfully just messing with this concept of information.
But when Achtung Baby was released, November 1991, at least one YouTube member, drummer Larry Mullen Jr., just wanted to play music.
This whole thing of the conscience of rock and roll and whatever was just this heap just thrown at us. And it took us a long time to actually get over that. And we spent a lot of time trying to explain it and justify it and justify our position, because it's not what we were trying to do or what we were trying to say. And it just, it became this big, big thing.
It was the Life of Brian vibe.
Yeah, it was very,
it's like,
very heavy.
You know, we're not the Messiah.
We're just not very naughty boys.
but it's also important that you don't back off either. And what happened and what we helped, I think, start in the 80s was a kind of positive protest movement that was kind of, that brought about things like Live Aid and brought about things like the Conspiracy of Hope Tour, and we're very proud of those things.
Should be.
And our own audience are very effective politically. And, you know, the Amnesty International doubled its membership after that tour.
Oh, that's terrific. Our
audience is made up of, you know, we think they're really smart, and kind of some of them just want to get involved and roll up the sleeves. We still feel as angry as we ever felt. We've just got better at disguising it.
Yeah. great song, Blow Your House Down, a bonus track on U2's Achtung Baby. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio thanking the lads of U2. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2016, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet, theme song by Andy Timmon. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.